Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The question, why there are no good men left, isn't really about us boys, it's about the women. Something called the Girl Project. Like many such experiments, it began in colleges everywhere. The girls in this project, millions of them, are the daughters of the 60s feminists. They roared through their college courses, soon outnumbering the boys. They Title IX'd their way to fitness and confidence. They didn't bother looking for Mr. Right. They wanted an education, then a career, an apartment, and financial independence. And they took off like rockets into American society. But Pam Houston, we have a problem. The society that launched all these smart and successful single women into the future didn't figure out a way to bring them back down to the more earthly next step, marriage. Connection listeners, is it society's responsibility to help the contemporary single woman, to help her date and mate? Is the courtship system broken? And if so, who's supposed to fix it? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And my guest is Barbara Defoe Whitehead. She's the author of Why There Are No Good Men Left. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dick. Delighted to be here.
You call it a crisis in dating and mating. Why the word crisis?
Well, I think we are at a transitional moment in the mating system. Every society has a mating system designed to pair off people for the purposes of marriage.
Or at least making babies.
Or making babies. For about 200 years in this country, we've had a dominant mating system in mainstream America, and it's romantic courtship leading to marriage. Today, however, I think, where I argue in the book, we're in the process of transitioning to a new kind of mating system that is very different in its characteristics, in its timetable, and its purposes from the one that's prevailed for a very long time.
It's that sort of crisis that's illustrated in the book, Bridget Jones' Diary. We'll listen to a little scene. This is when Bridget Jones is invited to a dinner party of all couples, mind you.
Hey, Bridge, how's your love life? Still going out with that publishing chap?
No.
It's every day myself.
Never dip your nib in the office ink.
Right.
You really ought to hurry up and get sprogged up, you know, old girl. Times are running out. Tick-tock.
Yes. Tell me, is it 1 in 4 marriages that end in divorce now, or 1 in 3?
1 in 3. Seriously, though. Office is full of single girls in their 30s. Fine physical specimens, but they just can't seem to hold down a chap.
Yes. Why is it there are so many unmarried women in their 30s these days, Bridget?
And it's into that great painful dinner party pause that Barbara Defoe Whitehead delivers her book, Why There Are No Good Men Left. Is that the right way of putting it, that there are no good men left?
No, I derived the title for the book from this popular conception, which turns out to be a misconception, that there's an absolute dearth of eligible men for women to marry when they're in their 30s. In fact, statistically, that's just dead wrong, especially if you're a white, educated young woman in your 20s or 30s. Upwards of 97% of such women are likely to marry at least once in their lifetime.
Okay, let's back up on those statistics, because we began the program by talking about that horrible Newsweek 5% number or whatever it was, and you mark in your book that the Census Board said, oh, well, no, maybe it'll be 40% of the women who manage to marry. And then there's this Princeton study that says 97% of them will marry. So, I mean, I just get lost.
Well, there, you know, these are projections based on a lot of assumptions that are fairly technical about behavior that in the future based on past behavior. But the Princeton study, which is the most recent one I looked at women in 1995 who were single, college educated, white, and not yet married, and they projected out into the future based on a whole set of technical assumptions, and they came up with this 97% figure, thereby overturning the myth that that women are doomed to singlehood if they aren't married by the time they're 25 or 30.
Early in the book, Barbara, you note a change in language that women, perhaps men, don't say anymore, I'm going to fall in love, I have fallen in love, I want to fall in love. It's, I want a relationship, I'm in a relationship, I want to get out of this relationship. Is that just a semantic change, or do you think that points to something that bigger under the surface?
No, I think it's reflective of some deeper changes that I try to delineate in the book. You have to remember that the old mating system, the one that I would say is a bit in eclipse now, was aimed at a population,
dead, isn't it?
Nearly dead, especially for younger adults, was aimed at a population of never married, single, young people. They were mainly in school at the time that they were courting. They had lots of leisure time. They weren't in the workplace. And they followed a fairly common set of rituals, practices, and standards that helped them achieve the one and only goal of this mating system, which was marriage.
Now, the rituals were largely putting the pressure on the boys, right? To come, to make the phone call, to get the date, to propose, to buy the, you know, to all that sort of thing.
That is exactly right. In this older mating system, men were required to take the romantic initiative. And a lot of the common courtship practices were based on the idea that men had to have the kind of romantic ambition, the desire to make the first overture, to propose marriage, to take these important steps toward moving up a ladder of commitment toward the ultimate goal in this mating system, which was marriage. And that has very much faded from practice for younger adults today. Now, there's some question about who should take the romantic initiative. There's confusion about what the common practices should be that would designate levels of commitment. And importantly, it's an older and more diverse population of dating singles out there.
And the reason why you point to the old courtship rituals and the absence of any rituals in the relationship cycle as you describe it now is talking about what the responsibility of society is, that it was under the old system, the responsibility of society to see to it that boys and girls got together and got married, had babies, and so on. But that today, society having this mounted this girl project of creating all these rocket ship women doesn't really have, hasn't created any kind of system. Is it society's responsibility to do that, or is it the responsibility of the smart, successful, well-educated women that you're describing?
Well, as I said, if it is solely a do-it-yourself project that's left entirely up to individuals sort of roaming around and improvising as they go along, it will be quite a unique innovation in human history because, as I said, societies tend to have predictable ways for young adults to meet each other and pair off. So that's why I believe we're in a kind of transition phase. A new mating system is, and some of those courtship rituals are slowly emerging. There are stirrings of change. And I think, though you can't legislate it, you can't order up a courtship system, one will emerge.
It's more than a transition phase, though, that you're describing. It's like a no man's zone. It's a dead zone, isn't it? I mean, that until those systems are put in place, there's a tremendous amount of confusion that you heard from the women that you spoke to.
From the women I spoke to, registered and recorded in all the popular literature that's obsessed with women's dating discontents, in the sort of shop talk and girl talk that goes on where women complain about, you know, how do we find the guys? How do we express interest in a fellow? How do we know that he's serious? This is all up for grabs and a source of confusion and perplexity.
No, I should be specific that in the research that you did, you focused very specifically on a group of women who we could describe as middle or upper class, white, well-educated, got a good job, largely urban, not rural. I mean, this is a specific group we're talking about.
Right. And I selected those women not because they're necessarily representative of all single women out there, but because they represent a kind of cultural ideal of progressive womanhood. And so I selected women who fit those characteristics and were also into their late 20s and early 30s and unpartnered or certainly looking now for someone to be a life partner.
Now, let me ask you something else, because you have, I understand, nieces and daughters.
Yes,
who
indeed.
Fit this mold of young and unattached women in the workforce. You can compare their life, their circumstances, to your life and your circumstances. Do you see advantages that they have that you don't have? This is not a great long exercise in pity that you're talking about.
Not in pity and not in nostalgia. In fact, I was more, the more I got into this, the more impressed and admiring I became of these young women who, like my daughters, have a record of educational and career accomplishment, who are confident, who have don't have some of the insecurities and uncertainties that my generation had about playing a full and commanding role in the workplace. So in every respect, I find them an admirable and exemplary group, and all the more power to us and our society if we continue to produce them.
You know, they're part of this Ethan Waters urban tribe. They, in many ways, can be envied. So what's the problem?
Well, they tell us what the problem is, which is at some point in their life, maybe in their 30s, they begin to think about, you know, permanence, about having an intimate partner for the long haul, about sharing a common history, and even children with one other individual. So their dilemma, or plight, as I call it, is finding the right man at the right time in their early adult lives.
But is that the problem, that they've chosen to find the right man at the right time, almost like they've scheduled it in their lives? Is it too much the hunt for the trophy husband?
Now, I didn't find that. I wondered about that, but it's much more a sense that they're operating according assumptions based on the old courtship system, where romantic love flowers and happens just when you want it to, and not realizing or being fully aware of how the environment for dating and mating has changed around them.
But you're critical of them as well. You say they're too giving, too forgiving, too obliging with sex, not asking for anything in return. This is the list of things that you go down when you criticize them.
Well, it's an interesting difference, isn't it? Because in their work lives, of course, they're quite the opposite. They're very assertive and confident and know exactly what they want. It's in this realm of love where perhaps they do, out of confusion or not knowing quite how to win the heart of a partner, they give away too much too soon.
My guest is Barbara Defoe Whitehead. Her new book is Why There Are No Good Men Left, The Romantic Plight of the New Single Woman. Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. What do you think? Do you think society has a responsibility to zero in on the plight that's being described in the book? Give us a call. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
To collect them in, they wear them like notches on a gun. Oh, honey, but I know better than that. I know that a woman only needs one good man. Oh, oh, baby, don't you know I've been looking.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. With me in the studio, Barbara Defoe Whitehead, author of Why There Are No Good Men Left. In fact, it's a book about the women who are saying there are no good men left. And you know the women we're talking about. You may work with them in your office place. If you don't, you've probably watched them on television in shows like Sex and the City. Here's a little clip from that television series where the character Charlotte, desperate to find out when she will get married, goes to so far as to see a tarot card reader.
Now, pick three cards, face down, with your left hand.
Charlotte had heard about Noni through a sorority sister, whose marriage she had very accurately predicted.
Okay. Now, is there one question in particular?
Well, no. Just, there is. When will I get married?
Ace of Wands, prosperity. Nine of Cups, strength and independence. The Hanged Man, a new awakening. You're a strong, independent woman with great success in your future, but I do not see marriage.
Excuse me?
I don't see it.
What?
I don't see marriage.
Well, how can you just say that like that? I mean, what about my feelings?
Honey, I'm a psychic. I'm not a shrink.
Tarot cards, there's a way of doing it. It does, in a way, Barbara, point to that whole idea that there are expectations among this group of women that you're talking about. And are they reasonable or are they unreasonable that having taken care of their financial independence and their education, that there is an expectation that that marriage thing is going to just happen?
Well, I think there is that expectation, and it's the source then of disappointment or at least concern when it doesn't automatically happen according to the preconception that, you know, once I get my ducks in a row and get my career launched, that the next stage in my life will be finding the right man. What happens is that the search is longer. It takes a little bit more mindfulness and entrepreneurial imagination for women today, precisely because the infrastructure of a courtship system that's specifically designed for her and designed to lead her into mating and marriage doesn't really exist. And so there's this, gee, this sense of what happened? I thought this was the last thing in my life I would have to worry about or work hard for. And suddenly it becomes a source of work and concentration and thought.
And stress.
And stress.
1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. Let's go first to Louisville, Kentucky, and Shandley's calling in. Hi, Shandley.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
I am a 35-year-old single woman. I'm a lawyer and a doctor, JD, MD. And I think what I find is that I'm very happy in my life. I have a nice home. I have a nice car. I have great friends, great family. I'm very fulfilled in many ways. What I'm looking for in a mate is intimacy and friendship and that kind of thing. I don't need a man now to put a roof over my head, to give me any particular legal status as women used to. Yet I don't think men today are being raised towards that goal. Men my age, at least what I find, is that men are still raised to think, well, I will be a good husband when I can provide a good home and make a good living and do all those things that I no longer need a man to do.
What about babies?
You know, it's a concern, and I think I have decided I will either do it on my own or adopt. I go to a point where I don't make one, I'll do that on my own too.
And Chandler, when you talk about intimacy, are you talking about marriage?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, but not necessarily,
Yes, but not necessarily. I mean, I would love that to happen, but that is not my goal in the end.
Well, this is a classic situation and one that's all the more common today. Women finding a life partner is the one thing that women aren't able to do all on their own, and everything else is certainly easily within their grasp. It's interesting to note too that because of this, women's aspirations are for intimacy, a best friend relationship, much more than they are for someone who's a good provider or even a good father. So this is a very, very typical kind of response from well-educated women. It's Very common.
Chandler, let me ask you something. If you were 18 or 19 and we were having this conversation, you'd probably be living closer to home. Your parents, your family, your hometown structure would be there to, that would put you in situations where, as we were saying earlier in the program, society helps you meet or spend time with men of the same age. Given that you are where you are today at 35, completely independent, with all this qualifications and comfort in life, does society have some kind of a role that it's not fulfilling in saying, hey, what can we do for you?
I don't know, honestly. I find that it is harder for me to date now being indie and a fairly attractive woman and a very outgoing, kind person, you know, with a big heart. That actually has made it much more difficult for me to date, not time-wise, but...
Are you overqualified? Are you too smart?
No.
Are you scary? What?
I guess it's... I don't know if it's intimidating or if it's... I don't know what the man's concern is, but I have found that it is much... The more qualified I get, the more independent I get, the stronger I get on my own, the more difficult it is to find a mate. Now, how society could help me in that... I'm not sure. I would love to hear your all's answer on that, and I will follow and do whatever I can to make it better.
Well, I think Chandler brings up a good point, which is men have not made this transition to thinking in about emotional intimacy and to a new mating system where they're likely to meet and fall in love with women who are at least as well educated as they are, if not more. So there is a part of this that I think is... requires social and cultural education on the part of men to really work for women like Chandler.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Chandler, thanks for your call. We're going to Carl, who's joining us from Leominster, in Massachusetts. Hi, Carl.
Yes, hi. How are you?
Thanks for calling.
Good, good. I just wanted to give my two cents on this. I've grown up as a highly educated professional man and in an environment that was very progressive and enlightened and had a strong feminist theme in it, thanks to my mom and sisters and friends. And yet I grew up feeling that the type of marriage that was offered by society was not the sort of thing that I would ever want for myself.
You mean the old type, Carl?
Well, I meant even the new type that I saw growing up in the 60s and 70s, that the type of sexist oppression that had previously existed in the U.S. and still exists elsewhere had changed to a different set of sexist and oppressive norms, such that I would be willing to get married only for the sake of the security of children, but the actual institution and its legal aspects didn't appeal to me much at all.
What about falling in love? What about intimacy? What about
those things? I think in my own case and in the case of most of the men that I know, the idea of having love and intimacy throughout life with a special partner, the idea of having children and having family and then being able to enjoy them through grandchildren and such has always been very appealing. But just as women back in the 30s, 40s, 50s started to reject the type of marriage they were offered in this country, and just as women in Singapore and Japan are rejecting the marriages offered to them today, I think many modern men look at what they're being offered and think of it as not being particularly appealing. There is a power differential, and I don't know how best to solve some of these issues, but it is somewhat oppressive to men, I think. And until we can have a better balance, I think...
What's oppressive? Be more specific. Give me an example of sort of the oppression that you're talking about.
Sure, I'll give you an example. The type of free choice that women were given through feminism was to say, for instance, that you have the right to choose whether to have a career or not. No one can tell you that you can't have a career and you should only be a homemaker. But what that's translated into is women have the right to choose But that's predicated on men not having the same right, basically because both parties can't choose, responsibly at least, to be unemployed and stay home and be homemakers. If women are given the choice to always have the option to work or not work, it's predicated on men having to work. Well, I don't know, other than individuals negotiating their own lives in a more enlightened fashion, how to get around that. I don't think any one model is right. It was wrong to tell women that their only career is homemaker. It's wrong to tell men that your only option, realistically speaking, is to work in some sort of career and not be a homemaker.
Carl puts his finger on that whole question of how to define success. Now, he's coming at it from a male perspective. You write about it from a female perspective, a career and marriage, career or marriage, career then marriage. I mean,
right. I mean, I think I'm not sure we're as normless as Carl might think, or at least I don't see that in the conversations I've had. It seems to me that both men and women share one thing, and that is they want to love and to work. And exactly how you put that package together in equitable ways, of course, is one of the great challenges of contemporary marriage. And but I do see people doing it successfully. And it does involve some level of personal negotiation and deciding what's important to the couple themselves.
You do go to marriage, though, on this, because the idea of a long-term relationship, children in a long-term relationship, I mean, your other job with the National Marriage Project at Rutgers University. I mean, that's...
Right. I look at trends that affect marriage. Marriage is changing, and it also is in the relationship between the genders and in the norms that define what a marital partnership is. And also, marriage is just one kind of relationship now, surrounded by other kinds of intimate partnerships. And both of those things are very different from what we were accustomed to in the past.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. And this hour, we're talking about a shift that's taking place, described in a new book by Barbara Whitehead, Why There Are No Good Men Left, from the old courtship rituals to whatever we have today, and whether or not it's everybody's individual task to find their way through that, or whether or not society needs to shift a little bit to make a little bit of space for the people we're talking about. Let's go to Ipswich, Massachusetts now. Mary Lou's joining us. Hi, Mary Lou.
Hi there.
Thanks for calling.
Sure. Well, I haven't had a chance to read your book yet, but I am calling just to thank you for bringing this issue to the forefront. As someone who was one of the women you describe looking to get married in my 30s and finding very frustrating to kind of balance my life, I got very infuriated about the sense that I had made this choice to become a career woman over getting married, as if that choice had been handed to me at some point. As it turned out in my life, I hadn't met the right person, so I had to go along and take care of myself and get a job, and I'm certainly happy I did that. But especially lately with this pressure that coming through the media about women needing to start having children younger, because their biological clock and stop waiting and stop being so selfish, I find completely infuriating, because I know that's not the case with many of my friends who find themselves, at this stage in life still looking to find the right person.
Well, I couldn't agree more. My book says that the answer to women's plight is not to tell them that they failed somehow, or they have to marry earlier, or that they're in trouble because their biological clock is ticking. I think the plight is the result of mainly good things, women's progress in education and in careers. But we do need now to have a better way of matching people up at a time, according to a time that fits this new life pattern for women. And I do think society can help to do that. And the marketplace, interestingly enough, can help to do that.
What do you mean by the marketplace?
Well, if you look at the way that the new mating system is taking shape, the most interesting and innovative responses to the plight of the new single woman have not come from the traditional sources, from faith communities, families, but from the marketplace
from
where there are commercial
internet
commercial introduction services, because they study demographics and they're trying to respond to this situation that women feel somewhat at a loss to solve all on their own.
Mary Lou, are you with someone or married now?
Unfortunately, I'm recently divorced. I did marry in my mid-30s.
I was going to ask you for advice. I'm wondering if I should now.
Well,
what did you find, though, when you were married in your mid-30s? I mean, what was the route through that worked for you?
Well, I think I finally reached a point. I mean, I don't think it occurred to me that I really wanted to get married until I probably hit my early 30s. And of course, I started thinking about children at that point. And I went through a series of, unsuccessful relationships with the wrong people and learned some lessons. And it was one of those things where the right person came along at a time when I wasn't really looking. The reasons it didn't work out are completely,
none of my
business. To do with that. But it is interesting that now that I'm single again and I think about the future, I have a child and I think about the future possibility of getting married again, the pressure isn't the same on me. I don't feel this need to get married again. Like, I felt a need to get married several years ago. So I like the position I'm in right now. And I'm grateful, actually, that I did live on my own, and I was independent for many years, because when I found myself in this situation, now as a single mother, I was confident that I could handle it alone.
Thanks a lot for your call, Mary Lou.
Okay.
Do you think, Barbara, that women put unrealistic or unreasonable pressure on themselves to find the person now because the time is right? I mean, what Mary Lou's talking about and what you describe in a couple of the women that you interviewed is that waiting's not necessarily a bad thing.
Waiting is not a bad thing, and women express this view that they do feel certain kinds of social pressure, maybe not as much as women in the past did, to marry, and if you aren't married, why aren't you, and what about your ticking biological clock? So there are these sort of subtle pressures on women, even though they now increasingly represent a bigger group of women in the society to marry up, because that still seems to be the, first of all, the goal, and certainly still quite a bit of the norm.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, and we're talking about a shift from the courtroom or the courtship system of old to the relationship cycle that we see today, and interested in hearing from you about your own experiences and your thoughts about whether or not society has to play a greater role in figuring out how to make the shift from one to the other. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. My guest is Barbara Defoe Whitehead. Her new book is called Why There Are No Good Men Left. Her first book is called The Divorce Culture. And I thought we might just speak a little bit about that, Barbara, because Mary Lou raised the question of divorce in her life. And it's certainly, I mean, it's in the room here. When these women are trying to figure out what's best for them, that's a consideration, is it not?
Divorce figures in the story I have to tell in two very important ways. One, it was one of the reasons that drove the Girl Project. That is, young women today are reared to be armored against the economic deprivations of divorce. Today's young women grew up in the midst of high divorce rates, and they really have to be prepared to be single and go it alone because of the divorce risk.
Our mothers were taught that either get a job or get married, you're going to get economic security either way. and
that's true, and it's no longer true.
Right.
And like it or not, this is a social reality, so women have to be able to go it alone. Second thing is that divorce makes people more cautious about marriage, and rightly so. So that one of the reasons that women, and I think men, wait longer before they make this choice of a life partner is because they desperately want it to be successful, and they want to avoid a lot of the economic and emotional hardships that are attendant upon divorce. So the later age of first marriage today is partly, I believe, a response to relationships in a high divorce society.
But the other thing that's gone that you point out with the old courtship system are the old public promises that went along with that. This
right.
is in your description of the difference between marriage and a long-term cohabitation. There's no sort of public promise on the male or the female part to be a part of that, that at any point either one can say, yeah, it's not working out. I'm going
right.
to go and find a place on my own. So are you saying that we need to try and preserve some of the public promise aspect of the old system, some of the commitment that existed in the institution of marriage, that cohabitation is just not going to replace that?
I think that's right. I think, you know, the jokes about commitment-phobic men or sometimes commitment-phobic women reflect a reality, which is that people do want to know where a relationship is headed, what the level of longevity might be. And in many of the informal relationships, intimate partnerships that people now enter into, there is no sort of public recognition of the union, nor is there very often even a private understanding that's mutual and carefully thought out about the nature or duration of the informal relationship.
Because to have that conversation is dangerous to the relationship at the point when it's beginning,
exactly.
Right?
And part of the whole idea of not making a permanent commitment is that you're not going to decide whether or not you're going
right.
to be together. So you enter with probably a lower level of commitment, deliberately so. But what I found was that many women got into these sort of more informal and testing out for possibilities of marriage partnership, and then lost a lot of time in a relationship that then went nowhere or failed, not because it just proved unworthy, but because they made assumptions about their partner's desires and aspirations for the relationship that never eventuated. And so there was a great deal of distress about that, and also time off of the time lost when they might have been out in the mating market finding
right.
a suitable partner.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Raleigh, North Carolina. Tina's joining us. Hello, Tina.
Hello there.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I'm getting married in this May, and I'm 29.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And I don't know if I want to say society needs to change. Getting married to me was a big step, and I think it should be for anybody, but I wasn't almost quite ready to get rid of my singleness. I enjoy my career, and I enjoy dating and having relationships, and to me, honesty is important, and communication, and I think what the lady was just saying just a minute ago about everyone communicating, the partner communicating, the partner not communicating, those are what's important, and I think it needs to be more of an introspective course than a society change. We have to look at ourselves and what our needs are first. I just don't see that happening.
Tina, when you went through the list of things that you wanted to be and to preserve as you went on into marriage, did that mean that your list of prospective male companions was narrowed as a result of that?
Definitely, and definitely as I was dating, I'm very picky, and wanted a man who was going to accept me for me, and wanted someone who did not mind that I was independent and had my own career and had decisions, and I think maybe men need to take an introspective look. But again, I don't think I see it as a society needing to change. I think people need to be more honest about what their needs are.
Or what their expectations are.
Yeah, what their needs and expectations are. And too many books like The Rules and things like that throw too much too much uncertainty into it when it doesn't need to be all of that. There doesn't need to be all these games when there's dating, as long as you're completely honest about what your needs and expectations are.
Barbara, let me hear from you.
Well, you know, I agree with that in theory and in principle, but in practice, private discussions and communication and understandings can sometimes be fraught with difficulty, misunderstanding, and even outright deception. And I agree that maybe society isn't quite the right word to use, but public certainly. I think for those marriage-minded women who want a long-lasting commitment, it is useful to have certain objective measures that are publicly recognized, and it could be engagement rings or even a shared household that mark a progression in the relationship, because I have heard many stories about, he said this, but he meant that. So communication may be overrated. Communication accompanied with some public symbols and rituals might be the ideal solution.
Okay. Tina, thank you very much for your call to Newton, Massachusetts now. And Susan's joining us. Hi, Susan.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I wanted to comment that I think that society has not caught up with what is called the feminist revolution or the women's revolution, as in, for example, Arlie Hochschild's book about 10 years ago called The Second Shift, which I'm sure your guest knows. She says that people have do not expect and cannot expect that they will be provided by society, no matter how hard they work and try, with the tools needed to raise a family, with child care, with split shifts or different kinds of work strategies and schedules, and that is holding a lot of people up. And I'm in my 70s, so I'm in a totally different generation from most of your callers, but I see
what would you see change, though, Susan? What's missing?
Encouragement by governmental authorities as well as by business and other employers to allow people to, for example, more people could work part-time. A husband and wife could each work part-time. That's very difficult to find, while at the same time taking care of their children. Governmentally supported child care, as in almost every other advanced country in the world, we're the only one who really does a very poor job of that.
And if we back up just a little bit, Susan, though, does that help the woman find the man in the first place, or does it just make it easier to figure it out once they're together?
I think it's probably more the latter, but I think that people may hesitate to... I think it's partly both, but
right.
I think it is people don't want to jump into something often knowing they're going to have a very hard time of it.
Barbara, I hadn't thought about the work aspect of it that Susan's describing, but...
Well, it's an interesting point, and I certainly agree that we have to do more to make work and family life or even love lives more compatible with each other. But, it reminds me, too, that leisure, having enough free time to court and to socialize and to have social contact with other like-minded, eligible single people is somewhat shrinking. I mean, it's very...
especially when people have to spend, 10, 12 hours a day at the office when that's not the place that you're supposed to be hunting for a mate, right?
Exactly right. And so in some ways, work is the enemy of love as well as of family time. Pardon me?
Too much work, I think.
That's right. And overinvestment in work or just plain old work demands added to the challenges of just maintaining a household and doing errands shrinks the available time that one has to get out and meet people and have fun. And that is a factor, too, in this transformation of love and romance in American society today.
Susan, thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you.
Nice to have you on the program. You said something earlier, Barbara, that I wanted to come back to. You talked about lost time. A woman in a relationship, whether it's 2 months or 3 months or 3 years, if that relationship doesn't lead to something more permanent, at least the women you talk to, refer to that as lost time. So it's kind of a boy question here.
Yeah.
It's not all lost time, is it?
Well, no, it depends on what you're long-term objectives are. If you are marriage-minded, and not all women are, and people do learn from failed relationships, they tell me. But if you are marriage-minded and you're a 30-something woman, and you mm-hmm. do also, in addition to that, have the ambition and goal of having biological children with your future life partner, let's face it, there is a certain kind of time frame in which you have to accomplish some things, find the man, establish his commitment, establish that he is similarly dedicated to both marriage and children, which all men are not, and make this union legal and have the child. There is a bit of a time restriction there. And so if women do get into relationships that they hope will lead to marriage and children, and allow too much of time to be spent and invested in a single relationship mm-hmm. only to see it fail, they have less time available than to go back into the market and search again for a partner.
And did you find in talking to the women that this could also be alienating for the men who feel like, not that they're getting into a relationship that is open-ended, but they're being interviewed for a job as a husband. And you know, sometime within the first few weeks or months, you know, some of the important questions have to be answered because there's something ticking.
Well, you raise an interesting point. It seems that there isn't a happy middle, that either there's too much of a rush to establish intentions or too little of a rush to establish intentions. And it's interesting because when people talk about romance and love and marriage, the language has shifted much more to a industrial and work-based model, so that the resume for a husband or a future mm-hmm. wife comes into play. Some of the job technologies now have come to the fore as mate searching and selection technologies. So there is a fusion of these two worlds, work and love, that used to be separate and distinct. One focused, directed, time-sensitive, efficient, the other leisurely, lazy, not heedless of time. That difference is now eroding.
So what are you telling your daughters when they go, Mom?
You know, I try not to put all my theories and advice on my daughters, so they find themselves really, I think, left to their own devices and desires rather than to what their mother tells them or advises them to do.
Barbara, it was nice having you on the program.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
Barbara Defoe Whitehead, author of Why There Are No Good Men Left, The Romantic Plight of the New Single Woman. Barbara's co-director of the National Marriage Project at Rutgers University, and also author of The Divorce Culture. Connection listeners, you're welcome to continue this conversation. You can find us on our forum pages at our website, theconnection.org. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Elaine Grant, Kelly Jones, Orit Karitsky-Fox, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Cassettes and CDs of The Connection are available from WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced. Visit us online at www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR.